Hello, everybody. I'm here with Dr. Kathleen Smith. She is a licensed therapist and writer who lives in Washington, D.C. Her books include Everything Isn't Terrible and True to You, a therapist's guide to stop pleasing others and start being yourself. She is a faculty member at the Bowen Center for the Study of the Family and the author of a popular newsletter, The Anxious Overachiever. I have both her books. And I am a subscriber to her newsletter. She's a fantastic writer and thinker. And I'm happy to have you here, Kathleen. How
Thanks
you
for
doing?
having me. I'm great.
Oh, wonderful. Well, so just to start off, tell people about your newest book is True to You, A Therapist's Guide to Stop Pleasing Others and Start Being Yourself. What's the gist?
It's funny when you go through the process of publishing a book, the title gets changed a million times and you don't really have any control over it.
How did it, what did it start as?
So it started as a mouthful, but I liked it. It was called Built Not Borrowed. And my editor was like, that's a tongue twister. We have another book coming out with the word build in it, so we can't use it. That's just sort of how it is in the industry. But that, to me, that sort of original title kind of captured what I was getting at is how do there's nothing wrong with borrowing from others, but how do you start to get a little bit clearer with yourself about who you are and what you're about in a world where, I wrote about this yesterday. Our economy runs on people telling you what you need to be doing and what's important, in a way, in human history we've never seen before. So, I wanted to kind of to get at the meat of that.
Well, now that you say that, it's true. Whether it's news or advertising or whatever it is, somebody's always trying to tell us what to think.
Yeah, and I think about, just the we have more freedom as individuals, at least in our culture, than we have ever had before, which can also be paralyzing. And then we have a lot of people telling us what to do with that freedom. So that tension, I think, is really interesting, because there's a million different things you could do with your time, which our brains weren't really built to have.
Yeah, I was listening. I think it was, I forgot the name of the study or all the details of it, but it was something like the optimal amount of choices. Like if you have too many choices, your brain doesn't know what to do with it. And it's but if you have the right number of choices, then that's people enjoy that. It feels like freedom.
Like the Robert Frost number of choices, two paths. What's that famous psych study where people had to choose paintings?
I think it
And
was something like
if you choose from 10, you're more likely to keep your choice, but if it's like 100 or something, you're more likely to take it back and choose something different,
interesting. So what's this? What do you, when you say borrowed, things that we borrow or built versus borrowed, what's the borrowed part? Would it like,
Well, in Bowen theory or family systems, that idea of borrowing self, right? That we are, as humans, are built to sort of borrow and lend information and ways of functioning, right? From others, because we are this sort of what I call like a missionary species. There's this interesting research about how quickly in our brains, when we learn something, we are thinking about who to share that information with. And we gain social standing from that as well, right? So it's sort of this economy of like, I have something for you because it's worked for me and I think you need to do X, right? So there are all these people trying to sell us things. And we're also, borrowing and lending ourselves. So like, how do you just pay attention to that very natural process? And when does it get, Bowen's idea was that it got kind of amped up depending on the level of anxiety, right? And so I just think it's really fascinating to just kind of pick a day and pay attention to how automatic it is.
Yeah, that is, it is really fascinating. I was talking with somebody the other day. It wasn't a client, it was a friend, and they were just going through a hard time. And I could just watch in my own mind all the suggestions of what this person should do pop up. And I had to bite my tongue to not subtly offer suggestions, you know, just to listen to say, hey, I'm sorry you're going through that, you know. So, really,
Absolutely.
really interesting how automatic, like you're saying, how automatic it is.
And
Wow.
it's fascinating for me to kind of watch the domino chain with people. You know, I can think of once I was speaking with this woman who was just constantly giving advice to her daughter who was feeling hopeless, you know, and then she'd come to me and act hopeless. I don't know what to do, nothing works, you know, and if I'm not careful, I'm the next chain in the dominoes, you know. Like, okay, well, what about this, you know? And on you go, you know, and so it's just interesting to pay attention to.
Yeah, paying attention to both the borrowing side of it when I'm maybe looking for something from somebody else, and maybe when I'm offering the lend, that would be the lending part.
Yeah, and how much of our lending is about just reacting to the distress in others versus, you know, really being something for people.
Reacting to the distress in others, seeing somebody else uncomfortable gets me anxious.
Yeah.
Something like that. Yeah. If this isn't a negative thing, it seems like borrowing and lending is useful in some way. How do we work on it? You know, how when does it not when does it stop being useful?
Yeah, I mean, I like to ask people to just think of examples, you know, of when have you when has the help not been helpful? And when has it gotten in the way of really getting to know somebody, being interested in someone, seeing that they're capable, you know, really be, you know, like I said, being able to enjoy the relationship, because there's a little bit more of a clear line between themselves, them and you. And when has there been less so? You know, and I think that in tough times, it makes sense that the lines would blur and that serves a purpose. But, you know, they get families and other relationships, you know, they get locked in.
And so always it's one person always doing the lending or borrowing and gets more static in that way.
Absolutely. Yeah.
It's like when families view somebody in the family as less than capable in some way, and everything becomes about how that person is not capable, and then they act less than capable.
Yeah. I had an aunt, this is my mother's sister, who she was really sick when she was born and had a lot of medical challenges, and she had some she had a hard time in school. And that was the message in the family is, you know, she needs a lot of help, you know, and she never moved out of the house. You know, she lived with my grandparents until she died. And I had the unique vantage point of being somebody who because I was just younger, you know, of watching how capable she was, watching how much money she saved, right? Because everybody else was doing things for her, you know, and how, you know, she kept a job so consistently and was appreciated by people, you know, and it was cool to get to see that in a way that others couldn't. Not because I was more mature, just because of, you know, my position in the family, you know. And yet, there would be times where I would fall into doing things for her. It was easy for me to say, she can do this. You don't need to do this for her, you know. And then I would go home and visit and it was hard, you know, because all of a sudden I was in the middle of it, you know. So yeah, it's just really interesting to see it sort of kick in despite what you kind of intellectually know, kind of when you're in the soup of it. It's very easy to go along with because it's just the easy, you know, it's the quickest way to keep things chugging along.
Yeah, to go to when you're in the midst of it, to just kind of react to the pressures, the way they're moving, the current, rather than fight against it.
Absolutely.
It's so interesting that families that you can feel that in a relationship system. When you pay attention to it, you know.
And, you know, I think my go-to response is to get real judgy about it, what everyone else is doing and how they need to orient themselves differently, versus what am I doing and how can I potentially be a resource to the system if I keep at what I'm trying to do or want to do, because I tend to see others as the key to things getting better.
Well, you're not alone. I think mine's a little different. Mine would be more going with the flow, people pleasing. But again, trying to calm others down instead of what do I want to do? How can I be a resource to myself, others? It's easier just to sit back. Or it sounds like yours is like I know what's best for everybody.
Yeah, but I think I mean that's the therapist in me, I guess, right? Like I know about this. This is what I do for a living. You should do what I think. You know, most of the time I bite my tongue though, and then I just complain about it or stew about it, you know, inwardly,
Yeah.
or you know, talk complain to my husband about it. You know, he's a convenient tr person to triangle in, so like
Hear that.
externally I might not be very bossy, but internally I am, let's say.
I understand that. So tell me a little bit, Kathleen, how did you get into psychotherapy or counseling in general?
You know, I think it's so fascinating because it has changed over the years, but I am a real introvert. In this, I'm also an only child, so I delight in being left alone and doing my own thing. And so it's kind of weird that I would end up in a field where I'm not, you know, I'm very much not have to be very present with people, you know, a significant amount of the day, but I do really like to get to the heart of things quickly. I'm not big on superficial conversation. You know, I want to know the weirdest thing about people and you know, what their sibling position is and feel connected to them in that way, right? And so, I think that it makes sense, you know, that I would end up in the field I did. And I, you know, I had this experience when I was in college. My mother died, and I didn't really go to see a counselor or a therapist, but I do think that that kind of sparked the beginning of my interest in family systems and sort of how a family orients itself after a big event like that. And so, you know, so I think that's how, though I didn't start focusing on family systems when I was in a doctoral program for counseling. I think I veered that direction because of that event and my thinking about it and, you know, and just instantly found it interesting and applicable to myself and my own family. And I'm also just really interested in characters, you know, like the. As somebody, you know, who enjoys writing and reading, and you know, I told you earlier, I love fictional people and what they're doing with themselves. And so there's no end to the characters I hear about, you know, or meet in my work with people. And I found that really interesting. And so, you know, I'm never going to get tired hearing about family stories, you know, and I don't think I've ever worked with anybody that I haven't found pretty interesting, you know, because of that.
Yeah, I think when you really listen to people and they open up, people are endlessly fascinating. What makes them go round, what they do, how they think about what they do, or don't think about what they do.
People come to therapy and they're worried that you're judging them, right? Which is always fascinating to me because my always thought is like, whoa, this is really interesting. I wonder what they're gonna do. You know, like I'm waiting to see what's in the next chapter. You know, very seldom am I like, oh God, here they go again, you know?
Yeah,
But you know,
it's
people worry
true.
about that, which kind of cracks me up, you know?
Yeah, but I think it has something to do with what you were talking about earlier, how under anxiety we just get so focused on other people, and people come in anxious.
Yeah.
So you got into family therapy. You had your interest in stories and your experience and your family, and it seemed to make sense for you. How did you find your way to kind of more the systems thinking particular? Bowen theory.
Yeah, so I think one thing I didn't mention is that before I went into counseling, I had a brief stint in divinity school. So I was interested potentially in becoming clergy because I very much was raised, going to church multiple times a week. That was another big part of my life. And I had decided that was not for me, but I still had this interest in how religious system organizations functioned as well, because there's nothing I love more than hearing people's like drama, of what's going on, at the church or their synagogue or wherever, like it, I love it because I was raised, these grand stories of like half the church splitting in two, or the pastor having an affair with somebody's wife, and running off with them, that was really interesting to me. And so what I found really cool about coming to the Bowen theory world was that there were these people who were clinicians, but there were also people who were clergy or who were interested in working with congregations, with businesses, and just sort of the diversity in that was really interesting to me, because I got to kind of pull back in that sort of religious interest while still being a therapist. And I was like, wait, I can do both at the same time? This is great. And so this the idea that it applies to human systems anywhere, and it's not as much about sort of the diagnosing and fixing that happens in the therapy world was really cool. And I kind of wanted more of that. And I think that's a big reason why I kind of stuck around. Because it's, what I love to say, with my writing and with the thinking, it's like, if you're a human, this will probably be interesting to you, because it is so broad and it is an attempt to describe sort of what humans do. So, sorry, that
And
was a
that
long
applies.
answer.
No, it's a great answer. And it applies, and that applies to all the human relationship systems, whether it's a church or a faculty at a university, or a
There's never
business.
drama at a university. What are you talking about?
That is funny. You started off in the church and you found your way back to it. What's been your experience with people, clients bringing up spirituality? I was thinking about that the other day.
Yeah, I love working with people who are getting clearer with themselves about what they believe and what's guiding them. In particular, people who are from traditions that are a little more, the togetherness is strong. Like sometimes they're called like a high demand group, right? Or like a where there's not a lot of flexibility. I go to a church where people are like, we don't care what you believe, you're welcome here, right? Like but people who sort of are growing up in traditions where there can be a high cost to sort of define yourself in a different way, both in the family and the other groups that you're a part of, how people manage to do that is really interesting to me. Also people who are in interfaith marriages or getting into one is really interesting to kind of think through with people. Anything that's an opportunity for that clarity is really a privilege to kind of get to observe people working on.
It's interesting. I think it goes back to what you're talking about the absorbing and borrowing, especially when you're brought up in a religion that's pretty traditional and rigid. There's a lot of absorption, And then, how do you help people think through it, not get rid of it, but think through it and decide? I think is it would that be? Am I catching that?
Yeah. And I think just, how I think about how beliefs reflect the emotional process in a family too, I can think of one family I worked with once where one parent started to gravitate toward a particular religion, and then one of the kids converted to a different one. You know, who knows how much of people's actual thinking goes into it? You know, I'm not here to judge that, but it was fascinating to observe that polarity sort of emerge. And what's about oneself and what's about sort of moving towards or being allergic to sort of what's happening in the family, you know? How much of our own beliefs are really about ourselves and our own thinking? I mean, it's kind of sobering, you know. Not maybe
Yeah,
not that
it's
many.
yeah. So the Baptist preacher's daughter becomes a Catholic or a Buddhist. It's interesting. Kevin, how did you have you always been a writer? You got these two books out. You're writing a newsletter every almost, is it every week now?
Yes, it's every week. It's a good practice. I mean, I have always been a writer. I did, you know, sort of before and during graduate school, I worked as a freelance writer and even a reporter for a couple different newspapers and didn't really have the journalism background, but people kind of let me do it, which I was, and then I had this experience in grad school where I started to freelance, you know, for some counseling magazines and psychotherapy magazines. And I had a professor tell me, don't get distracted. That's not what you're here to do. You're here to write your dissertation and do research, which was true to a degree. But then it made me think, oh, wait, what if this is what I'm here to do? You know, what if I don't want to be an academic? That's okay, you know? And so that was a useful relationship for me to be in. You know, and I thought, I just love sort of the work of making ideas accessible and you know, translating them to some degree so that people who aren't professionals can find them useful. And it's a cool exercise of getting clearer with myself about ideas and what is it I'm actually trying to say. And you know, how does your thinking change over time? That's the trouble with writing. Once you write something, if it's out there, it's forever, but your thinking might change about it, you know, and that's okay.
Yeah. It's your process gets instantiated in the world there.
Yeah, you know, and it's, you know, I've presented on this before. It is also a writing is a relationship thing, you know. When are you focused on how something is going to be received or how people are going to react to it or what they like and don't like, right? All of those voices are kind of in your head, and how do you set that aside and sort of plug away what's interesting to you? You know, every now and then I'll sort of get amnesia and reach out to people or ask, you know, people who read my stuff, like, what do you want to hear? What are you interested in? And I've never found that to be particularly useful. Like when you're trying to contort yourself in a million different ways, you know, to get an audience, people can kind of sniff that out. So I try not to kind of be too externally focused in that way.
You know, it's in so in it did this idea, there's an idea in Bowen theory about defining self, or they call it differentiation in Bowen land. It sounds like this relationship to your professor at that time that was like, hey, this is research, what are you doing here? Was like a moment of, is that what I want to do, or is maybe this thing what I want to do? It was kind of a moment where you got some definition. Sounds like writing is part of that process for you. Is that pretty accurate?
So I think it's easier in some ways, right? Because you don't get the immediate reaction from others in the way that you do if you're talking to somebody face to face, right? You can kind of hide behind it a little bit, but you know, people are still engaging with it or not engaging with it, and that's, you know, that's a reaction you have to deal with and think about. And you know, I think, you know, there's all kinds of interesting research about sort of what writing does for the brain and how it is useful for our thinking, right? And you know, even writing by hand more so than typing. And I think about how much of that is lost. You know, I'm reading this really interesting book about these two sort of academics in the late 19th century who got married and they were writing like, you know, letters back and forth to each other. And it's really fun to read because you also see the relationship stuff, like the overfunctioning, the anxiety, in a way that maybe you don't as much observing people. And I think that's just so cool. Like, is that lost to some degree with the fact that we're not writing to each other anymore? I guess you get it some in email, but texting, I think, is too instantaneous because the anxiety is just sort of like immediately transmitted. But are people not really defining themselves in the same ways, or do they not have the opportunities to do because they don't write letters to each other anymore, you know?
That's a great question.
Or if, you know, ChatGPT is writing their
Writing
letters
your letter
for
for you. Yeah. I can imagine somebody doing that. Write a love letter to my mom,
Well, can I turn the question back on you a little? I mean, I know you're the interviewer, but like for you,
Yeah.
for things you've written, like how do you think about the relationship piece of that?
I realize how disorg well, first of all, when I write, I realize how disorganized my thinking actually is on something. And then I'm like, okay, I need to spend a little time on this, and writing for me is one way to get clearer, you know? And I loved what you said about when I'm writing, if I'm focused on what people want to hear, maybe I'm not being authentic in some way in myself. But the relationship component of it, I write my wife letters all the time, you know, little notes, letters, things like that. And I find it's a great way to express myself and to stay connected. I don't know if that's the relationship component you're thinking of, but it's one way it works for me.
Sure. My daughter is like 6 and a half, and so she keeps a little sort of journal that she's writing in over the summer about the things she's doing. And it's been fascinating to watch how it's useful for me to see what's important to her and what stands out in what we do, and how that might be different than what I might have guessed, right? About like what's the best thing about, you know, this vacation or this piece of like camp she's doing, right? And I do think about how like writing kind of teases that out.
Like what's important, what stands out in people's attention versus what they don't write about.
Yeah, you know, because if I asked her what was the best thing about vacation, she's going to say everything, right? But if she has a page where she decides what she writes about, you know, she has to get clear.
That's true, because you're making a decision about what you want to give your attention and energy to, or where it did go. So interesting. I hadn't thought much about it like that, but I think that's true. When you're writing, what you're invested in, maybe can come out. That's interesting. Do you ever have clients write, or do you have clients that do write that it's useful to them?
Absolutely. And I think of the people who sort of get the most out of the time, which has very little, if anything, to do with me, are the folks who have sat down and tried to organize their thoughts in writing about what they're up against, what they're trying to do, what they want, you know, what are the opportunities moving forward. People get clearer, I think, a lot faster. And I think they're also less hard on themselves. It helps them be more objective, you know. And so I will often tell, I'm not trying to put myself out of business, but I will often suggest to people, are you sure you want to meet again this soon? Or do you want to spend an hour with your own, which is free, you know, with your own thoughts about what you want to do with this challenge? You might get more out of that. But we don't, you know, we want to go to the relationship component, you know, so quickly versus being with our own minds. So, you know.
Well, I think it's really true. We use relationships to manage ourselves. What's the difficulty with being with one's own mind? That's such a great way to put it.
I mean, I think increasingly, right? It's easy to sort of pick on the world we live in and the tech stuff, but I mean, it's true that we just have less practice being with our own minds than because you can, you know, I think the ideas in, you know, systems thinking about the relationship patterns, I think they've been true for, you know, a long time because we see them in the natural world as well. But I think technology makes it easier to activate those patterns, right? For, you know, 1,000 years ago, I've got to find another person to go complain to. You know, now I've got my phone. I've access to any number of people, you know, I could triangle in, right? And so that, you know, that's just the constant relationship piece that's always there.
It's a so technology makes it quicker, more accessible type of thing.
Yeah. Easier to hit the button, you know, and it makes it easier to distance too, right? So it can kind of work in both ways. So.
Distance, like if somebody's having trouble in the family or in a marriage, they can just get online.
Yeah. Or distance, like I can do my job without having to be in the same
Oh,
room with
that's true.
another person. There, not everybody has that option, obviously, but like, you know, you can kind of get by with less. I can order food and not have to interact with another person, right? So.
Yeah, that's true. So Kathleen, can you tell me a little bit more about the writing and relationship connection that you were drawing?
Sure. The example I love to give is when I was working on my book, Everything Isn't Terrible. I went away on a writing for retreat for 2 weeks. It was like, this was pre-kid, some of the best weeks of my life, you know, being alone, but also getting to interact with other writers. And I was kind of plugging away at this thing. And then at the end of the retreat, I sent the chapters I had written to my agent to take a look at. And immediately my anxiety went up because all of a sudden it was a relationship thing, right? Every thought I had had about this is great, I love this, which was probably overly positive at the time. Suddenly it was like, oh, this is terrible. Like, what is she gonna say? Right? And it was really fascinating to just kind of observe how once you turn it over to another person, you're thinking about it and your worry about it changes, right? Because and not that you can't have those worries while you're creating, but I think once it's sort of out there, it's kind of a different animal. And that was a really cool thing for me to track in my career as a writer, was not necessarily the success of the writing, but the degree of kind of mental illness I had in relationship to it, you know? And something I think I've gotten better at, you know, with this last book, there wasn't as much of the worry about what happened with it because my job was just to kind of keep going on to the next thing versus trying to convince people that it was good or they needed to buy it or whatever. And so, you know, and I can do that because it's not how I make my living, right? I recognize if somebody wants to pay the bills on it, you know, it's a different ball game. But, you know, I think for me, sort of the degree of external focus, the degree of sort of those imagined threats, right, that we talk about, if that gets dialed down a little bit, I count that as progress. And also my reactivity to when people have strong opinions, you know, if somebody, I don't get too many mean emails, but like every now and then somebody will send me one, and it really used to kind of throw me and kind of ruin my whole day. And now I'm a little bit, you know, it's not that I don't feel the reactivity, but I think I can kind of get back in the saddle a little bit more quickly and see that a lot of it doesn't have as much to do with me. I got way more reactivity about my writing the first couple months of the pandemic, and I was able to say, well, that makes sense. People are anxious right now. They got free time. They can send me any emails. Like, you know, that was helpful to kind of get objective about that, you know? And so, and also, you know, people, I don't write too much about cut off, but that's a topic that really brings out people's reactivity. You know, if they're not talking to their parents or somebody else, right? They will let you know. And yet, to me, that's just coming into contact with sort of the intensity in the family, you know, and that helps me stay objective about people's reactions, you know. So, you know, having those markers that are more about sort of progress with self versus external success, I think is really helpful.
Yeah, I think what you said about it being about the work is really useful, is a good marker. Like if in my own experience, if I'm focused on just doing the work, getting clear about something, whether it's writing or even with clients or with teaching, if I'm focused on what I'm doing rather than how I'm being received all the time, it's usually turns out a lot better.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And I think the same applies for families too. You know, the people who are trying to change themselves to get others to function better don't usually get very far with that. You know, like you know, I give the example in my book, you know, and I talk with people about this all the time, you know, people who are like, okay, well, if I start doing less, then my husband will take out the trash or my wife will, you know, start being on time more, you know, and still a focus on the other, right? Versus the folks who are like, well, I'm just going to see what I can do with myself and see what happens, you know, in the family. And that'll be interesting. You know, that's not trying to engineer any particular outcome, right? I think those people kind of get farther than the ones who are trying to do the magic trick of, you know, if I grow up, you'll grow up, right?
Yeah. I can make you grow up by growing up.
Yes. You know? I'm going to be you know, I remember my mother would say when I was a kid, you know, she'd try and kill people with kindness, she would say. And, you know, but there was just such an intensity to that, you know. I don't know how helpful that was.
I hear you.
You know, the focus was still on the other person.
Yep. Kill them with kindness.
Yeah.
Eric, when I was talking with Eric Thompson a while ago, he had a great example of, he said, my wife was having an affair with Bridgerton, you know, the TV show. And he's like, rather than getting worked up about it, I made a plan for how I'm going to manage myself for 3 days, you know.
That's great.
But just that idea of not getting the focus off of what the other's doing. It's really useful, I think. I think that was from your first book, right? Everything Isn't Terrible. You had this map of other focus versus self-focus.
Sure, I don't know.
Yeah,
Maybe one of them.
I think so. I've given it to clients before. What's your sense of what gets this other focus going? You said that, I think you said imagine threats.
I was gonna say being awake.
Being awake. It's true. Being alive. You know?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I think for me, it's just, you know, it has to do with the amount of anxiety in the system. And that also helps me not get too blamey and judgy on myself, right? When you just come into contact with that anxiety, you want to manage people. And groups need that. You know, I try not to get too, you know, I think I watch sort of what happens in a group where you need people who are concerned about whether people feel left out, whether people feel welcome, whether people get a chance to speak up. I think that's important. That's how groups function. You need that kind of cohesion, right? And, but you also need people who can say, well, if someone wants to speak up, they can do that. They can take responsibility for themselves. And, you know, so I think it is kind of a balance because if you had a system where people were just sort of totally disregarding what was going on in others, I'm not sure how well that system would function, right? So a little bit of other focus, I think, is useful. But so is a little bit of focus on how you want to represent yourself. And I think that's sort of what Bowen was getting at with this idea that you don't have to worry too much about the other focus because it's always going to be there, you know. There's no real danger of that of that not happening. So you might as well worry about yourself and what you're gonna do with yourself, because that's harder. I don't know.
It's the other focus is more like a default, you know. It's a natural state. I think the quote was, "You can't be all for others, and you can't be all for self." Gets at what you were saying too. How does, you know, this idea that you need different people in the system functioning a little differently, how does that relate to this idea of the emotional system, like that re human family, human relationship systems, church organizations, faculty administration, that they're emotional systems?
I think about this idea of how do systems become stuck and how they manage tension. And because that's what they're built to do to some degree, right? And but they're also built to get things done. And so how much energy goes into managing the tension and how much is left to solve problems, and meet goals, right? And I think in stressful times, more gets diverted towards managing the tension, which makes sense, right? But the benefit of having people with different strengths, different focuses, that diversity is really useful. At the Bowen Center, we had Dr. Joan Roughgarden come and speak to people at the spring conference, and her focus was on sexual diversity in nature. But she had this great quote where she said, let me see if I cannot butcher it. A system without diversity has no evolutionary potential. And I was like, oh, that's one to put on the wall. That's a great quote, right? And so it helped me think about, when people in a family don't want dis or a church don't want disagreement, they don't want that kind of conflict, right? A different way of thinking about it is, well, we've got some evolutionary potential here because there are people who are thinking about different things and people have different definitions about what the challenges are, and that can be an asset, right? Versus we need everybody focused on the same thing and putting effort in exactly the same direction. You've got to have some of that, but how do you see that diversity, like in the system, as being useful? And I think that helps people to think about their families differently because they see how some of these patterns, for better or worse, help the system kind of chug along or get through a challenge versus kind of diagnosing people and kind of labeling what's wrong with them.
You don't want to get the tension so low that there's no progress. I hear you.
I think I'm trying to think of an example where I've been a part of a group where that's happened. Usually that's not
Yeah,
the
usually
case.
there's tension.
Yes, and a lot of it.
But I think that's a great way to think about the emotional system. It's meant to manage tension, but also solve problems and move things forward. And I think my experience is when people, couples, families come in, it's the tension is so high, they're so focused on managing the tension that the problem solving goes down.
And how do you see the individuality is not a threat or a problem?
That's a tough one, you know. I think that happens in couples. It's really prominent. You can see it really well when they're so focused on the other person's description of what's going on in the relationship, that they can't help but try to correct it, because they see it as a threat to them, and then both of them start doing that. And it can become intractable for people, or seem to be anyway.
How do you not get stuck on needing like you said, the same definition of how things are going to get better versus, well, if my spouse became interested in what they want to do or this challenge, that's most of the battle right there, you know.
Yeah.
they're going to go a lot farther, you know, versus them just agreeing with me to calm things down or doing what I want them to do, you know. It's interesting to see.
Yeah, how do you, what have you seen with when people get curious? I think that like you just said it, getting invested in kind of solving the problem or interested, I think you said. I think people start moving forward when they get curious about things. But I don't know what turns that on all the time.
It's so hard to be curious about the person you're married to, or the child that you're worried about, right? Those are often the, you know, the hardest people to be curious about, because we're so invested in them. And, you know, I think when people can kind of make a project, you know, Jenny Brown talks about people making a project out of themselves, right? And I love that phrase of like, how do people have a good research question? Like, I talked with a woman once who she was single, she was dating, and she said something to me like, who would want to date someone, you know, who's 50? And I was like, well, you've got the right research question, but you're asking it in the wrong tone of voice. The question is, who would want to date someone who's 50? Am I interested in that question enough to go and find out, right? You know, and I think that's that difference of like, what will happen, you know, in my marriage if I start to manage myself differently, you know? That is very different than how do I get my husband to clean out the garage, right? you know, and or you know, or if it's questions about like intimacy or parenting or other things, you know, the how do you sort of take something as far as you can and give the other person the freedom to find their own way. But it's not instantaneous. It really is a journey, and I think that requires putting up with the discomfort of not having that quick fix.
Absolutely. And it's like we were talking about technology earlier. We're so damn programmed for the quick fix, you know, to want it. I don't think that's just a technology thing. I think it's a human thing, but it sure is easy to get easier to get relief when you have the your phone next to you than
Yeah.
something else.
Or an expert who says this is the way, you know.
You can, I can get on Instagram and find the answer. It's interesting what you were saying that the people most important to us kind of in those relationships, it's more difficult to manage ourselves. To stay focused on that way, than in relationships where the person maybe there's less intensity involved. What is it about the importance of the relationship that raises the intensity?
Well, I think the that individual also brings their own anxiety and invites us to manage them in ways too, right? And I think I think about I recently went to an award ceremony that my husband had at his work for something he had worked on. And it was really fascinating to me, you know. And I found, you know, it was something he'd been working on that I wasn't particularly interested in. We're in very different fields, so we do our own thing.
What does he do? What does he do?
Um,
If you don't mind.
he he is in like defense research, so like he is like, you know, he's, you know, he it's very important for him to be precise, whereas I'm kind of over here in the therapy world being like, oh, you know. But you know, and I'm sort of more individual picture. He's sort of, you know, the whole world, the sort of strategy, the whole scheme of things. And but it was fascinating how I was able to get more interested in what he was working on by coming into contact with with other people who were describing and saying nice things about him too. I think it was a really interesting kind of triangle, you know. And I was thinking about, you know, he doesn't come home and say, oh, you know, I'm so stressed about this. This is hard. He doesn't do that every day, right? But in our relationship, you pick up on sort of what's challenging, you know, and then it's easier to kind of tell somebody what to do or just not want to talk about it as much, right? And so it was fascinating for as an entry point for me to start to get interested about what he was working on, because I was able to hear about it and think about it in a way that was different than I'm coming home at the end of the day, we have this deadline coming up, right? That kind of just reactivity that I'm, you're more sensitive to when you're married to somebody. And so, so it was really cool to start to get more interested in something he had been working on, and think about it in a different way, because that fusion is just there to some degree, where you kind of pick up on not the content piece, but the sort of the feelings underneath it, and I think that was just so cool to kind of observe.
Oh, it's a great example. What was your husband doing when he was receiving the accolades?
It was interesting because they played this video of other colleagues sort of talking about each other and sort of complimenting each other, and it was interesting to kind of get to see people sort of share their observations about him and his efforts. That was really interesting, and I think it's just the challenge of how do you connect to, like, I think about it as a parent, right? The difference between worrying about your child together versus thinking about the challenges of parenting as individuals, but talking about that together, right? It's easier to start to get curious when you're doing the latter, right? Versus just kind of emoting and passing sort of the feelings back and forth. It's a good exercise.
It's like when there's more openness in the exchange between spouses, let's say, and there's more information going back and forth. People can get less, it's easier for people to get less worked up than if it's closed and it's just feeling coming up against feeling. Is it something like that?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
And just the that's where the those lines of sort of what is your responsibility get a little bit clearer, I think, and that's useful for people versus that, that blurring that occurs, when the tension goes up.
So when the tension goes up, it's where the responsibilities lie becomes murky. How do you help people get clear on that? That's the damnedest thing.
Yeah. I think I think people are pretty good at coming up with examples of when, when have you tried to do something for the other or been over responsible for them and it wasn't particularly helpful, Or what has been the cost of having others do things for you? What capabilities have you lost? Some of my favorite questions to ask people who are married is what could you do when you were single? That feels really hard now.
Interesting. That's a great question. What do you find that is there something common that people turn to or that you hear?
Well, it could be small stuff. Like, I hate to take the trash out. I never complained about it before, but now it's not my chore. So, I make a big deal if I have to do it. Or I think spending time with my family one to one, I'm more reactive to that now that I have a buffer that I could bring along. And so it's been really useful for me to try and spend time with my family by myself. And that's sort of a muscle that I can exercise. But I think, once you introduce another person, that kind of borrowing and lending is so automatic. You have to think about what you want to try and be able to do for yourself.
What, speaking of the one-on-one with people, in particular family, what's the idea behind that?
Yeah, I think, it's so hard to get out of those triangles that are used to manage the tension, you know, whether it's bringing your spouse along as a buffer or, you know, you're FaceTiming with somebody, let me put my kid on or my dog on to entertain you know, and manage that. Or, you know, not being able, if your parents are still married and living, like getting them separate, you know, there are a lot of ways that we sort of get comfortable through those triangles. And so it is a real workout to be able to learn, you know, what do you, that was sort of Bowen's idea. What do you learn about yourself in the process of A, trying to get people one to one, and B, sort of what you notice when you can do it, how hard it is to relate to people.
It's kind of like working on the internal muscles, so to speak, and mechanisms that, like, if your tendency is to distance, and you're trying to work one on one, how do you stay present with somebody? You're working on something in yourself as you do that.
Yeah. Versus if you have somebody in the room with you that you know will take your side or agrees with you about a belief or a choice or something else, right? You get a little bit of a boost from that. It's much harder
Oh,
to
I
stand
love it
up
when
for it by
everybody agrees with
yourself.
me.
Sorry.
Love it when everybody agrees with me.
It's so great.
What do you make of this? Speaking of triangles and families, this I want to say phenomenon. I'm sure it's been going on before, of people getting frustrated, angry, cutting off from family around politics. So and so voted for this person, so I can't talk to him anymore.
Yeah. I think it has
Is it?
less to do with the content and more with just the intensity, you know, and the level of societal anxiety. Also the reality that we can survive without those relationships in a way that we couldn't 1,000 years ago, right? So that
So it's
makes,
easier to distance in that
yeah,
way.
it's not that people couldn't be creative thousands of years ago and figure out ways to I'm sure they did, but it's that much easier now.
So that's interesting, though, the society, the anxiety in the broader society impacts the anxiety in the family in some way.
Yeah, and I think again, getting back to that borrowing and lending, you know, there are a lot of professionals who are sort of lending that as a solution and an answer too, you know. And to me, the question is always not, you know, it's not what you do, it's what's the thinking behind it or lack thereof.
So it's not that there's not a prescribed action. It's how are you deciding upon the action, going about the action?
Are you revisiting the action and considering that it's the best way to deal with the challenge?
Got it. Got it. I love I think maybe it's Bowen's quote. It's everybody's inherited a lifetime of tribulation. When and more or less so when you feel like you know the way, do the best you can with it. It's like you make the best decision you can, but that implies that there's some thought that went into it, not just the reactivity
Yeah.
to the
And
pressures.
I think decisions aren't often a one-time thing, right? Like if you are a Christian, let's say, do you revisit that decision every year and say, do I still, am I still signing up for these ideas? You know, and obviously there's lots of different definitions of Christian, but you know, if it's that important, I would hope so, you know? And I think the same thing with relationships. Like if you're not speaking to your mother, that's a pretty big deal. So can you put a reminder on your calendar every January to think about whether that's
The best route.
do you stick with that decision? Are you open to to contact? I would never presume to tell anyone what to do, right? But if it's significant, if it's a big enough deal, it's worth thinking about every now and then because our thinking changes, we have new data, new experiences. You know, and how do you kind of just work that muscle, you know, over and over again? Versus just the inertia of, I made this decision, so I guess I'll just keep doing what I've been doing, right?
Yeah, which I think that thinking that you just described at the end goes into how families can cut off from each other and forget what the hell the cutoff was originally about.
Yes.
You know, we don't talk to Uncle so and so. Why? Nobody knows. You know?
Yeah. You know, or they do know, but they're not thinking about, is that still a good enough reason? What have been the costs and benefits of this decision?
I find that so useful, this just asking people about what's the cost and benefit or what's the utility and the challenge of whatever they're thinking about or doing, you know, because most of the time I think there's two sides to a behavior or a decision.
It's very risky to turn the boat around, change directions if people are going to have reactions to that, right? I think about in my own family, there were some cousins that had sort of been cut off, and I started to make contact with them, and I had my grandmother say to me, "Well, you know what they did, right?" I said, "Yeah, I do." But I think it would be useful to have some contact with them. It stirs things up if you start to move a different way, because
I
it is
do.
easier to just kind of chug along as is.
Yeah. You know, thinking of just these stories that get built into families around what happens, what happened, it got me thinking. I was thinking about story before we started talking. I think you're a storyteller in your books, you get across ideas through stories. Is that something that came naturally to you? I know you've always been interested in characters, from what you were saying, but yeah, how do you think about this idea of story as a vehicle, as for ideas, concepts, education? What's been your experience?
About how humans are just narrative creatures, and we learn through stories and through relationships. But what I think is interesting about kind of systems thinking is it uses the story, but it also like pushes back against the stories that get told about why people are the way they are, or who's the villain, who's the hero. Right. And we all know the most interesting stories are the ones where it's those that's not so clear cut, right? And that's how families are in other systems. And so that's really interesting to me, to be able to kind of communicate that to people. And sort of what we very intuitively know when we're reading a novel, that the example I love to give is, so my daughter is really into villains. She'll be reading a story and I'll say, "Oh, are they a good guy or a bad guy?" And once I asked her and she said, "Well, he's kind of a medium guy." And I thought that was just the funniest answer, right? And I was like, "Oh, man, aren't we all medium guys?" And I think that's part of the work I do with people is how, not that people don't do horrible things, but sort of getting more towards that, that idea of sort of what Bowen talked about with not being overly negative or overly positive about people, seeing the medium guy. And what do you have to learn about the family or about yourself to start to see that, where people's actions, while you might not agree with them, they might make more sense, how that's useful.
Absolutely. I'm also thinking of, I don't know if this is what you were meaning, but it made me think of it, of not getting stuck in a story. But system that something about systems thinking gives you a way to see maybe the bigger evolving story of the family, and what your part in it is, can be, could be, you know.
Did you ever watch the TV show Lost?
Oh, I think I saw a few episodes a long time ago. Apparently, I got to go rewatch it.
What I loved about that show is they would in subsequent episodes, they would jump back to a previous scene, and it would be the same scene from a different character's perspective, and I loved that method of storytelling. It was so It was something that hadn't been done as much with television, and it was so cool to see, and get that different angle on things. And so how do people start to do that, with their families is really interesting to me.
Yeah, it is fascinating. It's if you're seeing everybody has a different family, even though they grow up in the same family.
Right. That idea.
Kathleen, what ideas are you thinking about these days?
What ideas am I thinking about? That's a
Yeah,
big
you're always
question.
writing. What's been on your
Yeah.
mind? What's been scratching
Okay,
underneath the
I'll tell you
surface?
something I've been thinking about. I'm thinking about the difference between getting clearer with yourself about where you want to put your energy and being a chicken. Like, how do you, because I ask myself this a lot, as somebody who has an interest in writing, and I'm also an only child, and so I'm kind of by myself a good amount, and I'm okay with that. But then I'm also asking myself, well, is that just getting away with not being a leader or not pushing myself to be in relationship with people in a different way, right? And so I've been thinking a lot about how do you know when a move you're making is about self, or is it just about managing the anxiety? If you're doing something and you think, well, I think this is good for me, versus is it just what everybody else is doing, and you look to others and what you should be doing. And I think that gets back to what we were talking about earlier with this infinite amount of choices we have about what to do with ourselves and how to live our lives. How do you make a decision about where to put the energy? Maybe I'm at midlife now, so maybe that's what it's about. You've got X amount of time, and how do you be thoughtful about what you do with it,
Yeah, how do you not I guess one way I've been thinking about something similar is like when my energy's not going in the right place, I get the sense of spinning my wheels. Like it doesn't take me forward in some way. But I like this idea of when am I being a chicken? Also.
Yeah, sometimes I use the analogy of the utility player in baseball, the person who can play different infield positions. And so I think like it's useful to relate to people in a way that's different for you, right? If you're a youngest, to step up and see what you can do with yourself as a leader, let's say. Or if you're an oldest and love to boss people around, it's a useful endeavor to be just a participant in something, and yet people have talents and capabilities that they should use. So how do you know sort of what's an opportunity to be flexible or to work on that flexibility versus doing what you're good at, what you know you want to do, right? Not everything has to be a learning opportunity.
You there's room to pursue your interests and just things that to pull you.
Yes. Versus I think, maybe that's the challenge of the therapist, is you're kind of thinking a lot about where do I need to be uncomfortable,
But that's a great question. Like, what are you drawn to? What are you interested in naturally that you're not putting your energy to? And what's getting in the way of that? I think ex I know for me, expectations about the what we think we should be doing can get in the way.
What should you be doing?
Yeah, I don't know. But whatever it is, it's not the hell what I'm doing.
My problem is the culture has incredibly unrealistic expectations about what people can do in a day or a lifetime, right? I mean, I think that's a challenge. You know, I don't know if you've read any of Oliver Berkman's stuff,
No, no, no.
4,000 Weeks. It's a great book, you know, and he talks about how sort of the big lie in the culture is that we'll someday finally get on top of things. And the sooner people can come to terms with the fact that that will not happen, you know, the better their life will be.
That's great
That
point.
kind of radicalized me, and I was like, that's true.
Yeah. I mean, I don't have to go 1,000 miles an hour every minute of the day,
Yeah.
you know?
You know, or the what do they say, the great sort of the thing adults tell themselves is next week things will slow down, you know.
I'll sleep when I'm
Then
dead,
you
you
die.
know? It's so true. As you've thought about that, as you've been radicalized, as you said, what's changed for you? Where have you put your energy?
I go to fewer meetings and I am trying to Zoom less. I recognize the irony of like as we're Zooming right now, but I think really focusing on, you know, what's going on in my neighborhood, you know, in my church, with the family. I just get more out of that, you know, than
Of more immediate local relationships.
kind of the admin of life, let's say, you know, the but you know, groups need people who will go to meetings and do things. That's essential. But I think this kind of pseudo productivity of the appearance of doing things. We've got a lot of that these days, so
I think so too.
yeah.
I wonder if the idea of things becoming more local is one antidote to this technology boom and the isolation that goes along with it.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the part of the problem, you know, with just sort of the news is that we're concerned with all these things that aren't local, and I'm not saying we shouldn't be, but I think people then tend to lose contact with what's happening or what are the challenges in your neighborhood, you know, or in your city, or you know, do you know your neighbors? Yeah, our brains are wired for that, you know.
That's really interesting. We're so concerned with these global issues, and yet it goes back to that one, we don't have one-on-one relationships with the people around us. And what would be different if we did? It's a great, great question. Thank you, Kathleen.
Would the world be better if everybody called their mother? I don't, maybe not.
Ah, that's what I'm titling the episode. I'm going to make it as a statement, though. The world would be better if you called your mother.
Haven't met everybody's mother, so I wouldn't presume to.
You.
My mom's dead, so I don't. I mean, how easy is that? Like, I don't even have to think about that at all, you know? So I don't know.
Call your mother. Don't call your mother. It's up to you.
It would be an interesting experiment, let's say.
I hear you. Thank you, Kathleen. I appreciate your time.
This is great. Thanks, Guillermo.
Great to have you.